What's up, my freaks, sharpness geeks, and purveyors of stabbing goodness? Welcome to the Knife Freak Show. I'm Jonathan McNeese, joined by my co-host, Mr. Chase Boatwright.
How you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
I can't complain. I've been working today. I took yesterday as Saturday, so I'm making Saturday my Friday, so, you know, that stuff.
That is one of the nice things about working for yourself. You can do that if you're not actually working 7 days a week, which happens way too often.
Yeah, that. But at the very least, I get five in, like, at the very least.
So. It does give you a little bit of flexibility, so that's good. Yeah, I actually was out. Well, I ran the machines a little bit. I ran a couple of pallets yesterday and a couple other small things, but I went hunting yesterday morning, so I didn't do a ton. But, you know, I've mentioned before, I think that we're working 410s in the shop now, so it's technically, other than the shipping department, but other than that, so it's technically with my off day anyway. But and then today I'm actually going to start some pallets as soon as we get done with the podcast. I've already got the machines warmed up, so anyway, that's the life of running a business.
Yep. As soon as we get done here, I'm gonna head back out to the shop and keep going. So
yep. Wouldn't have it any other way though.
No, I love it. So, but
all right, what we got lined up for today for these fine knife freaks?
Well, I was going, you know, a couple things in the news, sort of, you know, this week we had SHOT Show, or we didn't, but neither of us went, but you know,
no, I SHOT Show happened this year on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever been to SHOT Show?
I have never been to SHOT Show and I've been wanting to go for a while. You haven't either, right?
No.
Yeah.
Nope. Yeah. Never been further west than Texas. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
But
been to Vegas many times, but not for the old USN show, but not to SHOT Show.
Yeah. Just, whenever you, you know, decide to do that, why don't you just go ahead and grab an extra badge?
And,
you know,
hey,
I'll stow away somewhere.
I'll be honest with you, I'm not saying we are, but there's a fair chance we may attend SHOT. Well, I'd actually like to. At the very least, I want to attend, but I really like to set up and have a booth. We already looked into some of the pricing and stuff, so
yeah,
but we didn't nail down whether or not we for sure want to do, or, you know, like we're going to commit to it or not, but we're going to make a decision here pretty soon, and I would really love to do it. So
yeah, that's one of those difficult shows, like, I think, because it's only an exhibition. It's not a selling show, so it's like you don't get an immediate return, but you could get a lot in future return, you know,
networking and getting your stuff in front of a different crowd. That's one of the main reasons I want to go. I mean, there's plenty of knife freaks that go to the SHOT Show, but there's a whole lot. I mean, it's kind of more of a gun show, honestly, and, you know, gun related stuff. So, a lot of people that maybe aren't into our stuff, you know, that are still at the, you know, beginning level or beginner, one of the level one, two, or three, or somewhere in there on knives. You know, they like knives, but they're not really into the knife scene.
Yeah,
I'd love to try to get some of those folks brought over into making them true knife freaks.
Yeah. So, and for those of you that don't know, SHOT is actually an acronym that stands for Shooting, Hunting, and Outdoor and Tactical Show. So,
yeah, kind of encompasses it all, but it's mostly known as a gun tactical type show, whatever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously there's tons of knives and stuff there, but it's not specifically a knife show. So
yeah, for sure.
But from what I've heard, it's huge.
Yeah.
What I looked at though, when we were looking at the pricing and stuff, apparently they opened up, a different space, some more space. I don't know. They added like a different, exhibition hall or something.
Okay.
So there, I think that was where we were looking at it, like there was some space available in that hall or whatever. So
nice. I didn't know if they like clustered similar, you know, things. I didn't know if like all the knife people would be in one place and the guns would be in, you know, I don't know.
I don't, just from like video clips and stuff that I've seen, I don't necessarily think so.
Okay.
But, I don't know that for a fact. I think it's probably more to do with like how long you've been exhibiting. I mean, some of the people that have been exhibiting there for years probably are
in more, you know, premium locations. Yeah, I mean, sort of like Blade Show.
Yeah. I figure that's kind of the way it works. But
gotcha. I think I'm thinking of Iwa, the one over in Germany, does more stuff like that. It has like a bunch of different, they call them houses, and they, you know, knives are all in the same house, and guns are all, you know, bags are all in the same house and whatever. But gotcha.
That's cool.
Yeah. So yeah, you know, saw a lot of stuff, you know, a bunch of different people, you know, dealers and manufacturers and stuff posting stuff from SHOT Show. Yep. Main thing I saw was that CRKT folding hatchet thing.
Yeah, that Joe Caswell designed.
Yeah.
Yeah. That thing is going to be a big hit. It everybody already is. I saw it everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody posted it at some point. Yep. So it's a neat thing. Huge.
Yeah. I'm really anxious to get my hands on one and check it out and see. I'm sure it does feel great. I know. I mean, Joe Caswell is like a freaking mechanical genius, I think, basically. So yeah. I have no doubt it's completely awesome. I'm really anxious to see how it feels in hand, like when it's opened up, how sturdy it feels, like, you know, yeah, how much you can actually beat on stuff with it. And, you know, because I saw a couple of people kind of, you know, as always, you're going to have the haters out there and acting, yeah, like it was gimmicky or whatever, like it wouldn't be robust enough or whatever. But I'd be willing to bet, and just kind of looking at how the mechanism worked, that I bet it's pretty robust.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not like it's a full-sized axe anyway. It's not like you're going to be, you know, chopping down a 50-foot oak tree with it. Like,
yeah,
it's not. If you're carrying it in your pocket, chances are it's not for trees anyway. So
yeah. Yeah. I don't think it was technically an axe. I think it was more of a hawk or, you know, nature.
Yeah.
More tactical.
Other than stumbling tactical through the woods in the dark on occasion, I've never really been attacked by trees. So
yeah. I have been like once or twice. They just jump out of nowhere, yeah, and get you.
Yeah. Especially walking, like I said, through the woods at night or something, a limb slap you across the face. And it's like,
God, I hate that. Briars are the worst for me. But oh, you know, if there's a briar in the woods, I will find it. I guarantee you that. But anyway.
But I would agree that in the knife world, that was probably the most standout thing that I saw from SHOT Show.
So, yeah, me too. The most unique.
To be fair, I didn't see a lot of, you know, specific. I saw people with pictures of like being at people's booths and stuff.
Yeah.
But not a lot of like, hey, this is a big, you know, new model debut kind of thing. So
yeah.
But I did see. I don't know if it's. I don't know if it's specific to SHOT Show. I saw them announce it right before SHOT Show, so I'm assuming it kind of is. And I don't honestly know how I feel about it, but it is what it is. Saw that Magpul, the gun furniture company that makes magazines and furniture for ARs and stuff, apparently they've dabbled into the knife industry before, but they've just come out with a new knife, and they're teaming up with Blade HQ to, I don't know if they're exclusively going to sell it or what. It kind of looked like it. And it's from they're basically, what's the process called? It's MIM. What does that stand for?
Metal injection molded.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
So, cause you know, their thing is injection molding with their magazines and stuff, just usually polymers. Mm-hmm. So they're into metal injection molding. And so they've got a folder that's made metal injection molding process. So
that's interesting.
That's something else I'd like to get in my hand. And actually, you know, I'm not one to like want to get stuff and like beat on it and stress test it and stuff like that. Other people's stuff, you know, just for the fun of it. But just for the curiosity of knowing going forward where maybe the industry is headed, or some different options that are out there, I would be really curious to see how those hold up to some lateral strength tests and stuff like that. If they're that may be great. It could even be better. Who knows? I don't know. I'm really curious to find out about that. See.
On that note of metal injection molding, I did actually see that Chris Reeve has come out with a new pocket clip that's basically it's a milled clip, quote unquote, but it's a metal injection molded titanium clip. So
really,
instead of their,
I haven't seen that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, instead of their standard spring clip, but they're still going to offer the standard spring clip, from what I understand. But that'll be like an extra add-on option.
That's very cool.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm gonna have to do some research on that. So then, do you know the difference between? I mean, yeah, I guess I kind of know the difference. But so there's a difference between metal injection molding and like 3D printing.
Yeah.
Metal.
Yeah.
So basically, the metal injection molding is essentially liquid metal that's being poured into a mold and formed into the object. Whereas, you know,
from what I understand,
essentially being liquefied or at least melted to the point that it, you know, can be printed, yeah, and then it's printed. I mean, it's very similar. It's, yeah, just basically sounds like one kind of uses a mold and one doesn't. At least that's what it seems like to me. I'm not an expert on either one of them, but
yeah, I mean, that, yeah, sort of same thing. I don't necessarily know, but that's, you know, what I would surmise from my limited understanding of both processes.
I'm very curious and very interested to see where the market goes or the industry goes over the next few years, mm-hmm, with some of these different techniques like that. And yep, I don't know how I feel about it. Like, on the one hand, like, kind of want to embrace technology and, you know, mm-hmm, if it's a better way, especially if it provides a better quality product in the end, at the same time, like, you know, it's feels a little weird getting away from the old ways or whatever. Of course, yeah. I mean, I guess the old ways are technically forging, and I don't forge, so I'm already kind of removed from the original process anyway. So
yeah, but I mean, you know, in both of our cases, even though we, you know, as we've discussed, make knives in different ways, we're still both stock removal makers. You know, right, we start with more material than we need, and we take away what we don't need till we have what, right, we want. And so,
with a certain amount of that's always involved, even in forging too. I mean, yeah, for the most part, I mean, there's going to be some filing, some grinding. Some, I mean, even, you know, years and years ago, there was, before grinders, they were filing and stuff like that to, yeah, finish shaping and stuff. So,
yeah,
yeah, additive versus subtractive manufacturing. Yeah. So, and additive manufacturing has changed the game and a lot of stuff, mm-hmm, you know, in recent years. So, I'm curious to see what it does to our industry.
Yeah. But yeah, I didn't know about that Magpul thing. I'll have to check that out. Yeah.
I'm much more interested and curious over the process and the quality of what comes out of it than I am the actual, like, design of the knife or any of that kind of stuff. I mean, it's,
yeah,
you know, it's, there's a ask for every seat when it comes to designs and stuff. So, like, that's,
yep,
it's not up to me whether it's a good or bad design or whatever. Like, that's, you know, that's a matter of opinion. So,
yep.
And I'd actually like to, I want to check one out. I really do. I hope they'll have them at Blade Show.
I would think.
Might get lucky. They might even have one at Blade Show, Texas. We'll see. Hmm. That would be, I'd really like to check one out and I'm also curious if there's anything you can really tell that it was made by that process versus traditional type processes.
Yeah, like, so, surface finish or surface porosity, right, or anything like that. Yeah.
Right. I'm very curious if it's just kind of, when you look at it, it's just a normal looking blade and,
yeah,
like,
oh, so the blade is additive, huh, as well. I was just thinking about the handle.
No, I think the blade, as a matter of fact, I'm not sure if the handles are or not.
Okay. My brain was just on the handles the whole time.
That's why I was talking about the testing. Well, unless, gotcha, I misunderstood, which that, I mean, because I don't think that the handles being, I mean, them being metal would be, I guess, maybe a little different twist, but things have been being made with injection molded technology for handles for a long time with polymers and stuff. So,
yeah,
I don't feel like that's quite as big of a leap as making the blade steel out of. I could be wrong, but I'm 99.9% sure, because it was a like different name for the steel or whatever. Like, it was a,
gotcha,
proprietary kind of thing, I believe,
yeah,
on the steel. So, yeah, that's why I'm interested in testing it and stuff. It's, yeah.
The only other blade I ever know of that was like sort of, it wasn't injection molded, but it was cast, was David Boy did his dendritic, yeah, cobalt blades. They were cast, right, blades. So,
right,
so I guess sort of a, you know, something like that, but be interesting. Yeah, yeah, definitely see it.
More, I'd like to get some more information on it. Maybe we can talk about it again at a later date. I'm sure somebody out there will, all the YouTubers will jump on it and be doing destruction testing and everything else, I'm sure. So,
yep,
I'm just curious to see what, you know, what those are versus traditional stuff. So,
yep.
But anyway.
On the note of guns crossing over with the knife world and that sort of stuff, I also saw that Chris Williams of Wilmot Grinders is teaming up with Bear Creek Arsenal to produce knives for them. And
that's cool.
Chris is a good dude. He's you know, you've, yep, got a Wilmot, and I've used that Wilmot, yep, many times, and,
yep,
you know, he makes phenomenal stuff. He's, you know, yeah, tight and right as far as engineering and knife making goes. So,
mm-hmm,
I was excited to kind of see that and see him, you know, get more of his stuff out there, because I think he's, you know, he focuses a lot on the grinders and other stuff. Yeah. And so, you know,
yeah, I think he's pulled in a lot of directions besides just straight up producing knives. So,
yeah.
But yeah, be anxious to see how this comes out. And that's cool. And it's always good to see more you know, especially it's always really good to see other industry oil in, I guess, other industries with the gun industry, somebody, you know, a gun company basically getting into having a knife line, but not just going straight overseas and having an OEM over there and just, you know, putting out something not meant.
It's not the $9, you know.
Yeah, and half the time, like I said, it's something. It's not just, you know, not even some of the stuff that we've been talking about from some of the higher priced OEM companies, but like the for real cheap stuff. Like
the Snap-on knife you see at the hardware store, you know.
Yeah, I've never understood how gun companies, you know, that sell, you know, premium guns. Like it's not like they're selling guns that you buy at Walmart. I'm talking about, you know, pistols that are $2,500, $3,000, mm-hmm. and then they'll team up with a company and make a knife and sell it for freaking $80 or something. It's like, what are you doing? Like that doesn't at all match your brand. Like, why are you teaming up with somebody that's, you know, it just, that doesn't make any sense to me. But any gun companies out there that want quality knives made, you know, look at what he says, Bear Creek Arsenal.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not particularly familiar with that gun company.
Reach out. I'd love to team up with some gun companies and get some stuff going, because that's another thing that's near and dear to my heart, the gun industry. So,
yep.
Yeah. Oh, anyway.
This is not on my schedule, but before I forget again, because I've been trying to do this since I think the first episode where you talked about the tracker with the Hamon from the maker back on USN way back in the day. I tracked down that maker like basically the week after we did that podcast, and I keep forgetting, but it was Tim Horan, and I will include his Arizona Custom Knives link in the description. That way you guys can go check it out and see.
I don't think we were able, from what I looked at when you sent me the link and stuff, I don't know that he's still making knives. He may be, I don't know.
Yeah, all the listings were old and all sold, and you know, from you know, a couple of years ago, and that was basically the only information I found on him. So, you know, I don't know, but it was still cool to be able to see those big old trackers with the Hamons on them and stuff.
They're cool, aren't they?
Yeah, I like that. Maybe I want to make one, which. Not something I need. I do not need that distraction right now.
Yeah, well,
but
sometimes you got to do it. But
sometimes you got to follow the muse. It, you know, it helps sometimes, but other times
just wait after Texas at least.
Yeah, yeah. Well, after Texas, I'll be in full bore for Atlanta. So you know,
that's
first 6 months of the year are basically just blocked off for me right now. So
that's kind of the way the whole year felt last year, and I guess it kind of will again this year too for us. Yeah. Like it's just. As we've added more shows and stuff, and that's what only thing that kind of gives me pause about SHOT Show and stuff. I'm like, when I was talking to Amy about it, I was like, you know, that's like right out of the gate, you know. And like we a lot of times we go to the mountains the week after, which we did this year, the week after New Year's. And so she's like, yeah, that'll probably knock that trip out. So we'll see. We might, if we have everything ready to go early enough, we could probably still squeeze it in and just be come home from the mountains, head to Vegas. But anyway, lots of moving around.
Yep. My last bit of news was something I also intended to include a couple episodes ago, is that Alex Steingraber of Steingraber Performance Knives has also started a podcast. I think it's just on YouTube, and they do it as like a live show and then just post it to YouTube. It's him and another manufacturer up there. I can't remember his name exactly. I apologize. I follow him on Instagram now, but and last I checked, they hadn't named the podcast, but I think they have now, and I can't remember the name, but it's just, if you go to Alex Steingraber on YouTube, just go to his profile. They're all there. So just wanted to mention that.
Very cool. Yep. Like to see other good people spreading information and putting their point of view out there and that kind of stuff. So sharing information.
Yep. So.
All right. Very good.
Instead of doing a freak of the week this week, I wanted to kind of do a show and tell because mainly I'm excited about it, but I've always wanted a AK-47 bayonet, and now I have one.
Oh, that's cool.
And it actually came to me courtesy of my father-in-law, who just has things for no apparent reason, and, you know. We were talking about AK-47s in the shop, in his shop, and, you know, just got on the knife subject because I was there, of course. And, yeah, so he just gave it to me, but
that is cool.
Sometime from the 90s, possibly, or, you know, I think he got it in the 90s, so it's probably 80s. Right. And a little bit of research I did right before is it's a Type 1 AK-47 bayonet. Don't know what that entirely all entails, but
I don't either.
It's got a Bakelite handle, some sort of composite pins. This right here is a little button that actually actuates the mechanism for it to slide onto the rifle. You guys can see that little thing moving right there. But yeah, as far as a bayonet goes, it's always been one of my favorites because it's the most knife-like. One of the most knife-like, and you know, seems to be just, you know, simple in its execution, but also just works really well, very much like the AK-47 itself. You know, so I mean, it's makes sense as a combo, and it's also got this really cool metal sheath or metal scabbard, I guess you would call it. It has this wire stripper or wire cutter feature up here.
Yep.
Let's see if I can do this on camera without cutting myself. Yeah. It goes in like that.
Yep.
Cuts the wire. It's got this portion that's rubber. That way, if the wire is electrified, you've got somewhere to hold it. And all this is Bakelite, is basically non-conductive. So, yeah. Just a really cool old school military knife that I've always wanted one. I've looked at them on eBay and just, you know, the prices were basically more than I was willing to pay. And I just happened to mention it to the right person and he was like, here you go. So that's now really I have cool. one. Yeah.
Now you're ready to slip behind enemy lines and infiltrate and
You
know, take out sentries and the whole works.
Indeed. But yeah,
that is really cool. Now you just got to have AK-47 to put it on.
That's what I said. That's what I told him. I was like, you know, well, you know, if I've got the knife, I might as well have an AK-47. And he said, he said something I won't repeat on the podcast because he has one. I know he does. But yeah. Yeah.
No, so, probably not getting that one gifted quite as easily.
No. But, you know, I figure, you know, I'll work my way to it. But we'll see.
Well, look, you're going to. I just remembered this as you were talking about that, and you're going to think I'm completely full of crap. But I swear to God, out of the blue, for no reason, last night, I dreamed that I had an AK-47. And I do not have an AK-47. But I had it for some reason. I don't remember what I was, like, what the context was. I just remember dreaming, and I was, like, you know, checking it out and, trying to get used to running the control, you know, running everything on it. Anyway, just randomly out of the blue, that's kind of weird. I guess you were telepathically letting me know something, I guess, there.
Yeah. I was telling you should buy two. Yeah, that's what I was saying. Did that come through in the dream? Yeah.
No, didn't quite. That one didn't quite come through.
But, yeah, just figured that was a very cool thing to, you know, show you guys, check out. And, you know, if you ever get the chance to pick one up, I'd recommend it because it's just a cool piece of, you know, history, a cool knife, and, you know.
Very cool.
I like it a lot.
Yep. I don't blame you. That's awesome.
Yep. So enough about my knife and the things that, you know.
Oh, yes. Kind of what we're here to talk about.
Yeah, this is true. But, yeah. So on to the next thing was something that's already been kind of tossing around in my mind. And then somebody may have posted a video earlier this week about the about people saying they can't manufacture in the U.S. And one of the things that was beat into my skull, like, you know, relentlessly was can't, never could. It was even on my first business cards for the business. And, you know, it's still like a mantra that I live by. And basically, you know, thinking about like people using can't as an excuse, it's not that they can't generally, it's that it's too difficult. It's not possible. It is hard. You know, and I was already thinking about it in terms of like, I'd heard someone the other day say like millennials can't own houses and can't own cars and all these things that millennials quote unquote can't do. I think I'm millennial. I don't actually know. I don't really believe in the whole pseudoscience of generations and nonsense like that, But, you know, I own a house. I own three cars. I own a business. And, you know, maybe I'm an outlier. Cool. But it doesn't mean it's not possible. It is possible. It's real, real hard to do. You know, I work relentlessly, but it's doable. It's possible. And I don't know. I think I hate the word can't so much that it just was something that got under my skin. But
yeah. Oh yeah. And it's true for a lot of things. And I don't know if that's I'm not sure if that's like a Southern thing or if that's, you know, you guys can comment and let us know if the whole, you know, can't never could, because that's definitely something I heard, you know, can't never did anything or can't never could do anything. I heard that my whole life growing up too. Yep. So, I don't know if that's a Southern thing or if it's nationwide, but if it's not, it should be, because it's definitely true.
Yeah.
And it applies to tons of stuff. Like you said, people, whether it's somebody wanting to do something, you know, like, dude, there's tons of people out there that are, you know, want to get into making knives or want to do stuff. And if you can make up excuse after excuse after excuse for why you can't, and because you don't have time, you don't have money to buy equipment, you don't have this or that, like, you and I are both perfect examples of, it's not like either one of us came from a, you know, knife making royalty and had a, you know, a family, or not that there's anything wrong with that either.
No,
like, we're not second or third generation knife makers that, you know, it was kind of the family business. It was just natural that we went into it, or, you know, we both worked for it. You know, we both had to find a way to do it and have the drive and have the, you know, the willingness to work past the really sucking really bad and grinding meat off your fingers, literally burning your fingers constantly, cutting yourself constantly, like all the actual literal physical discomfort that comes along with, you know, finishing standing at the grinder all day and your neck and your back and your everything else hurting. Like, honestly, a lot of people just do not have the physical grit and fortitude to do it.
You know?
But that's just one example. I mean, that's like, that applies to our discussion here.
Yeah.
I
think it's more of just I think it's more just like a mentality sort of that's,
yes,
almost sort of plaguing people these days, is like more so just, I can't do it. It's, and when they say that, they just mean it's too hard. I don't want to do it. The effort is too much for me to want to do it.
I'm not willing to pay the price.
Yeah.
Whatever that be,
that sort of ties back into our whole knockoff discussion a few episodes ago, where we were talking about, you don't want to put in the effort. You don't want to save. You don't want to wait on the gratification.
Real thing, whatever. Right.
It's the instant gratification culture, basically.
Yes. Yes. Because if you're basically buying knives at all, then, you know, over enough, or even if you're not, like, you can save up enough money over time to buy, you know, basically any knife out there, but for sure the ones that are, you know, we're talking about like $1,000 and under, you know, sure, there's some art knives out there in the tens of thousands of dollars, but like, it's, you know, it's for sure doable. Like you said, it's a matter of priorities, and people want to make excuses and for why they can't, and with why they can't afford something or why they, whatever. And then a few of those will go from just making excuses to bashing and saying it shouldn't cost so much. They get mad because they can't afford it. Well, because they have it in their heads that they can't afford it, and because they're not willing to afford it. And so, you know, we kind of talked about that some last week, but like, yeah, it's, and I'll be honest with you, without getting too much into some conspiracy theory type stuff, I honestly think that some of this, whether it's done intentionally or not, I actually believe some of it is done intentionally, but whether it's done intentionally or not, hearing stuff on the news and stuff, all these reports about, oh, these are the costs compared to 20 years ago. These are the costs, you know, these millennials compared to their parents and this and that, like, this is, and basically telling them that they can't, that, I mean, for a lot of people, for some people, it's like, oh, really? Watch me. Yeah. Like, it motivates some people, but for probably the majority of people, it gets it in their head. They have this identity then that they cannot do these things. And once they've created that identity for themselves in their minds, it is extremely difficult to ever break out of it. And so, like, whether it's intentional or not, and I believe some of it is, But all this stuff that you see in the news and in the everything else about, you know, all these reports and comparisons and talking about how you can't, like, that hurts a lot of people, because that they start to identify as somebody that can't, and then they could, but not if they can't break out of that identity and understand that it is possible. They just have to be willing to do certain things and make certain sacrifices and be patient and that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, that's why I don't pay attention to the whole millennial Gen X, Gen Z. I don't give a shit.
There are extremely poor people from every generation. There are extremely rich people from every generation. There are people that are super successful with, you know, like stuff besides money, like, you know, that have made discoveries, researched stuff, invented stuff, whatever, out of every generation. Like, there are wildly successful people from every generation that's ever been. So, like, it's not a generational thing. It's not, you know. Yes, are conditions different now than they were in the past? Yeah. But sometimes, you know, there's so many variables that how do you know for sure that, you know, it was actually easier then or whatever? Certain aspects of it might seem easier, but what about all these other variables that were there, you know? Yeah. Like, for example, now in this day and age, when I was a kid, like, you couldn't make money off of making videos and posting them online, you know, like... I mean, I'll be honest, even like when our kids, like I was still so, you know, old school enough, like when our kids were young and YouTube was just starting to get, you know, blow up, and they, you know, they're in there watching these people, you know, play video games and stuff and make videos of it. And we're like, why are you wasting your time doing that? Like, you know, just do something constructive or whatever. Yep. And then, you know, they start telling us, and I was wrong, you know, because, and while no, that's not, lots of people are not going to do that. There's tons of people out there that, you know, don't succeed doing that, but that's true of any road you go down.
Yeah.
But like, you know, I had no idea that there were kids or young adults, whatever, making, you know, millions of dollars from posting videos on YouTube of themselves playing video games and stuff.
Yep.
Like, I didn't understand that at the time.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it's baffling concept, and, you know, until it's like, oh, okay, that's a real thing. Like,
right. But my point is, there were, while prices may have been lower, like when I was younger and stuff, as a young adult, teenager and young adult, we also didn't have all the information at our fingertips. We didn't have the ability to, you couldn't go online and sell stuff.
Yeah.
There was no online. Yeah. Like, if you wanted to, like, do something to make money, like, you had to, you know, cut grass or find somewhere to set up and have a lemonade stand or sell what, you know what I mean? Like, you, there was nowhere available. There wasn't this online marketplace.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, it's easier now than it's ever been, despite what the economy is doing. In a lot of ways, it's easier now to do stuff and be successful, because you have not just information at your fingertips, but you have reach. You have a platform. If you have the ability to get in front of people, which you didn't have then. Like, I mean, not without, I mean, it was completely, you had to physically get in front of people. Like,
yeah. On a side note, there's a little kid that has a lemonade stand down my road, not necessarily the road I live on, but the road to the highway. And yeah, every time I see him out there, we stop and get a couple glasses.
That's awesome.
Terrible lemonade, but you know, I respect it. He's out there. It's like, you know, 98 degrees and he's out there doing his thing. So you know, I appreciate it, and I will give him, you know, as much support as I can give him. So,
right. That's awesome. But yeah, that's, so anyway, that's kind of getting off on a different topic, but
yes,
I firmly believe that whether it's something you want to do, whether it's something you want to buy, whatever, like, saying that you can't is basically just an excuse. Like, it's, you know, I mean, there's some things that are, you know, where it does hold true. I mean,
yeah,
I can't play professional basketball. You know, I don't have the physical abilities, even if I trained as hard as I could, to be able to be good enough to play professional basketball. You know, like, same. That's just not in the cards, you know, and never wanted to, but, you know, hey, but
as far as, like, you know, limiting yourself in something you're already into,
right.
You know, not necessarily trying to be like, you know, all of a sudden, hey, one day I want to be an astronaut, and you're already, you know, already 30 years into your career or whatever, like, you know, probably should have, done something in that beforehand, but just, specifically talking about like the manufacturing in the U.S. sort of thing for our industry, like, it's something I've, I've got quotes from different machine shops and stuff in the U.S. and, it's something I'm not able to do at this moment, but it's not, I'm not going to say I can't do it and then just go and take the easy route. I'm not, I'm not doing that. And you know, I'm continuing to work, continuing to try to build the business to the point where I can do that.
It's all a matter of people are impatient. They don't want to pay their dues. They don't want to do what it takes to get there. Like I said, if it's, and I've heard it so many times, and I've heard it from, and I almost hate to, I haven't talked about this as much as I've wanted to, just because I have people in the industry that are friends that I really like them and stuff. But then, but there's some of the same ones saying this, and like, I don't just intentionally want to step on people's toes or whatever. And I'm certainly not going to personally call anybody out, but like, it's like, they'll say, I can't do this, so I have to do this over here. Well, what am I doing over here? Like, did I mean, I didn't discover some magic fairy that shits knives. Like, I mean, come on now. Like, I literally started, as we've talked about, you know, like from a Frankenrod with no experience, no mentor, no nothing, literally started from going back to my shop, building a Frankengrinder, and starting to reinvest money from the very beginning into the business over and over and over again, sacrificing tons and tons of time. Like I was, like, y'all don't understand how little I was at the house with my family in those first several years when I was grinding it out and you know, trying to build up a brand and build up a reputation, like it, and build up my skills, most importantly. Like, I mean, I was every evening, I was out there until usually supper time and usually beyond, because I was usually late for supper. Almost every weekend on Saturday and Sunday, I was out there for a good chunk of the day, you know, grinding knives. This is on top of working my full-time job. Like, and wasn't willing to, you know, to just jump into it and be like, I'm a knife maker, and you know, making half of what I was making at my full-time job. Like, did both until I built it up to the point that I could make the switch without costing my family money. And then just kept growing it from there, doing the same thing, just reinvesting, growing it over and over, while, you know, while I've got friends, like, I've got a brother-in-law that, love him to death, he's constantly wanting me, like, over the years, he's constantly, hey, come up and go. We used to hunt and fish all the time. He moved to Georgia. Hey, come on, come up and go fishing with me. Let's go on a hunting trip out west. Let's do this. And, oh, man, I've got, you know, I'm going to be in the shop. Like, this, I've got stuff to do or whatever. Like, so just constant, or I've got a show coming up. I've got to go to a show, this and that. Like, just not doing a lot of the things that I could have been doing had I not been trying to grow the business, you know, sacrifice all that stuff. And then to get to this point now and be doing it again, like, we're not talking about somebody that had any sort of pedigree here. Like I told you, I built a Frank, had no, you know, no mentors, no whatever. Lots of people that gave me advice over the years, don't get me wrong, but no actual, nobody to show me, hey, this is how you do it. And then all the way to the point of when I did get ready to buy a CNC, getting it in the shop and literally not even knowing how to turn it on. Like, the dude is here. You were here, dude. Like, you saw the dude came to set the machine up, and like, he literally couldn't even like really go over anything with us because I had no clue what anything he was saying meant. Like, he literally just kind of skimmed over the whole thing because he was like, you're not going to know what any of this means.
Yeah. Like, basically,
did he, I mean, not?
He was like, this button does this, this button does this, this button does this. Here you go. Like, you know.
I mean, but
it was all stuff that made no sense to either of us because.
We're all standing there looking at each other like, yeah, I hope you remember that because I don't know what he's talking about.
I'm pretty sure you said that exact word, that phrase to me as soon as he left.
Yeah, like, I am too.
And I tried to remember some of it, but.
Yeah. So, I mean, we made it work though. Like we found somebody that could, like, you know, I started paying somebody to come and help that had some machining experience until I could learn it and that kind of stuff. Like it's so like, if I can do it, anybody out there can do it. Like, I mean, but can you do it today? No. Can you have a knife company up and running in 6 months and be making money and thinking you're a big shot? No.
Not without some sort of
ground zero like I did.
Yeah, not right. without some sort of like outside investor, you know, somebody like, right. you know, right. pumps a bunch of money in for you, but otherwise, right. you know.
That's right. So, but even then, that still makes it doable. The point is, yeah. it's doable.
Yeah.
Like you cannot say, I can't make my knives in the U.S. because it's 100% wrong because yep. I'm doing it. Lots of other people. And I mean, before me, and that's honestly what helped me was seeing people like Rick Hinder or Ernest Emerson, you know, people like
Les
that,
George,
you know, Strider, yeah. Les George, like, which he was still pretty much making customs when he's been a little bit on a little faster pace than me, I think, getting into the production stuff, but like still in a general.
He also had a lot of the CNC part already sort of, you know.
Well, yeah, he was smart enough to go back to school for, he knew what he wanted to get into when he got out of the Marine Corps and went straight into CNC school and all that. He was already into knife making and stuff. When I went back to school, I had no idea I was ever going to be into knife making. So, kudos to him for making smart choices.
Yeah.
But
I wish I could make more of those.
Hey, I made a smart choice by becoming friends with him. Now I get lots of advice from him.
Yeah.
So, it is definitely doable. Like when people say I can't, I have to have my stuff made over there. It's 100% not true. But what they really mean to say, if you break it down, is that they can't do it right now. They can't do it without, you know, traveling a long road. They can't do it without making a bunch of sacrifices. Like mm-hmm. That's what it comes down to, because mm-hmm. if it was not doable, like again, me, Les, Rick Hinder, all these guys are not, we don't have some magic thing or some whatever, like just got sprinkled with fairy dust and, oh, you're going to be able to make your knives in the U.S.
No,
like,
it was the hard way of learning, doing it.
Right.
And, you know, right. taking the licks on the chin, taking the bumps and, you know, learning right. from it. And
right. know. And there's guys out there like that. There's still lots of stuff I don't know about running a knife business. I feel like I know a decent amount about making knives. Mm-hmm. I don't know nearly as much as I need to about running a knife business. Like there's guys out there that know a whole lot more about marketing and that side kind of stuff than I do. And so they have a leg up on that end, but then taking that and then just shortcutting the other side of it. And I'm paying my dues on that now. You know what I mean? I'm learning. I'm not, you know, there's no shortcut on it. I'm just, you know, figuring it out,
yeah.
reading, learning, watching, you know, trying to figure out testing, trying to figure out how to build and how to market and how to grow our audience and that kind of stuff. Like this podcast is part of that.
Yep.
So it's just, it really frustrates me when people say, I can't do it. I'd love to, you know, it's really cool that you're doing it, you know, man, but I can't do mine in the U.S. wherever. Well, yeah, you can, but you're probably going to be coming back and talking to me in a few years. And yeah. I'm not saying it takes as long as I took to do it, dude. I could have made the switch in my mind. This goes back to what we were talking about earlier about the identity. All right. So, and I think you kind of know this because we talked about it a lot in the beginning when you know, because this was when I made this switch in identity was when you came along.
Yeah, basically.
So I always thought that it was cool that Rick Hinder and Ernest Emerson, all these guys that I keep talking about, were doing what they were doing, right? But I never really saw myself as being able to take that leap from a custom knife maker to doing that. I didn't have any idea of what it took. I didn't have any idea about production stuff, you know, nothing about CNC stuff. And then, you know, it slowly started creeping in my mind that I would like to do that or whatever. And it took me finally just realizing that, like, what one man can do, another can do. That's a quote from a really good movie, if you don't know what I'm referencing there. That's a quote mm-hmm. from the movie The Edge with Anthony Hopkins in it. Okay. They're trying to survive this man-hunting bear, mm-hmm. and they decide they're going to kill the bear. And he tells them, what one man can do, another can do, because he knew how, like, Indians and natives had killed bears, you know, or whatever, historically.
Gotcha.
And so he said, what one man can do, another can do. And so, anyway, I started thinking along that lines and you know, basically changed my identity of somebody that, okay, I'm just going to try to be a fairly popular custom maker, and this is just, you know, this the level we're going to be at, to, okay, we can actually turn this into something else. And then put in the time doing that. Like, it's just, you have to be willing to make the leap and do the stuff. And it's just, it's very frustrating when people claim I can't, when, like, we're sitting over here doing it.
Yeah.
Like, but the point I was, I got a little off track. The point I was making with that is it took me a long time because I didn't make my mind up until I was years into being a custom maker to do it. But it wouldn't really take that. Like if I started immediately, like if I wanted to start a knife company now and I was starting from ground zero, like you wouldn't even necessarily have to start as a handmade custom maker. You could go, I mean, lots of people start with CNCs. Lots of people start their journey there. And like, then you're already, you know, then it's just a matter of scaling up from there. So like, it doesn't mean it's going to take as long as it took me to get to this point. I mean, somebody might start out and get to this point within, you know, 3 or 4 years or whatever. Like, it's just, you know, are you going to be able to, you know, what it is though, everybody wants to be able to finance, like they don't want to put any actual money out on the line and stuff, part of it and the effort. Like, yeah, CNC costs money, but high CNC mill, like they offer financing. You can finance one. They're not that expensive when it comes down to it. So like, you know, you can make the leap and get started and start reinvesting your money back into the company. It's just, I mean, it's not easy. It's not safe. It's it's scary.
That's the part I think that really kind of gets people is it's not safe. It's taking a risk. I mean, you send money overseas and, you know, for the most part, you get a product, you know, there may be whatever, you know, specifications may be different than what you specifically asked for or whatever. They may be perfect, but you know, it's money product. It's there's no, you know,
there's no, what if I can't figure out how to do this?
Yeah.
Like somebody else has already figured it out. You're depending on them to do it. Like a lot of the risk is eliminated. I mean, sure, there's still, with any business venture, there's still risk involved.
Yeah,
but the more you do it like this, the riskier it is for sure. And that kind of brings me back a little bit to last week's discussion about pricing and stuff. That's another factor that people do not take into consideration when they're just looking at cost of materials and stuff. Like, even if you look at all the actual overhead, which I guarantee you, like I said last time, people would literally, like, they would choke if they knew the actual overhead it costs to, you know, the breakdown of what it costs to make a knife when you consider all the actual physical costs.
Yep.
But then also, what is living your life every single day, taking huge, giant risks, you know, like living with that stress, what is that worth? You know, like you take somebody, if I went to a casino and I had saved up $100,000 and I went to a casino and I bet all that $100,000 and I, you know, and I 10X'd it, say I bet that $100,000 and I won $1,000,000. Like, would you say that, like, you know, would anybody say that I didn't deserve that or whatever? Like, be, you know, like, no, dude had the balls to go lay down $100,000.
Yeah.
Like, he won, you know, now he's rich or whatever. Now he's got all that money.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, there's a lot to be said for all the stress and everything that goes along with being willing to take risks. And that's what, again, there's a certain amount of that goes with any business.
Yeah.
So when I'm talking about this and the pricing and stuff, I'm not really talking about, like, you know, sorry, OEM versus whatever, just in general, people are looking at pricing for businesses, like they're not factoring in anything to do with, you know, that person's daily life. If you, there's a whole lot of reason, I forget what the percentage is, but like a huge percentage of businesses do not make it, like a lot of, and so like in across all industries.
Yeah.
One of the reasons for that is because a lot of people cannot tolerate the risk and everything and the stress that comes along with what it takes to do that. So, you know,
it's tough. I mean, it's tough to live out on a limb basically. And, you know, try to balance every day. Like, you know,
and people completely discount that, you know, when they're not everybody, but the people that are, you know, again, it's only the people that
the vocal minority
can't afford it that are saying that anyway. But there are a lot of factors to look at when you're looking at, you know, why somebody's charging what they do for a product. And there's a certain amount to be said for that. And experience, you know, experience is another big one. Like, you know, okay, yeah, it may take me X amount of time and X dollars to make a knife right now, But how many years did I work to get to the point that I could make a knife of that quality in that amount of time? Mm-hmm. Like how many, you know, how many years did I put in to get the experience to do that? How much time did I put in training employees to be able to do, to replicate that,
yep.
you know, and back to what we talked about last week, how much scrap did we make, you know, while I was learning it. And then while the employees were learning it, like how much, you know, scrap and all that, how much cost of all that did we have to eat along the way to get to that point? The cost of prototyping, like that kind of stuff in actual material and tools and time, like to take out to prototype something and figure something out to do something different. Like
yeah.
all of that, none of that stuff. I mean, you don't see that stuff broken down on the cost of a knife. But if you made like a spreadsheet, you could have like, you know, like an invoice for a knife. You could have labor, you know, materials, labor, you know, prototyping costs, you know, waste factored in, or, you know, scrap factored in, like years of experience. Like there's all these things that you could list out mm-hmm. that are all factors that most people do not think about.
Yeah. So, and the product has to cover all of those costs. I mean, there's
and be able to still have enough yeah. money to live off of yeah. and, you know, for everybody to live off of, all your employers, employees, all the people, all the vendors that you're paying to, and then they're paying their employees and stuff, which is why their costs are what they are.
Yep.
And then still be able to turn around and reinvest in the business and grow it and continue moving forward. So yep. anyway, I won't take us too much farther down that rabbit hole, but
yeah. So basically can't, never could. Yep. It's just a way of saying I can't right now. So therefore it's too difficult for me to do ever. And
yeah. it's an excuse, is not being willing to pay the price and
yep.
make the sacrifices.
Yep.
So
with that, where are the Sodbusters at?
Sodbusters?
Yeah. Or rather, when are they coming back?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay. That was a question.
They are not. I got you.
But I intentionally didn't include it on your end.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You wanted to get me spur of the moment there. So I'll tell you that honestly, I was intending for a while, I thought the front flipper Sodbuster was going to be the next new model that we did. Mm-hmm. But then I did a kind of poll a while back where I asked a question on favorite opening mechanisms, and mm-hmm. front flippers and flippers in general were way behind thumb stud or thumb hole openers. And yep. so just based off of that, I decided not to go with the Sodbuster. We might end up, it definitely is not going to be the next model we do. We may end up, I have done some of those with thumb studs, so it's not impossible. We might figure out something with that and do a thumb opening version of them. If the flipping stuff stays, you know, not as popular. Or we may do some anyway. I just didn't want it to be the very next thing we did.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be the next model that we're coming out with, but there's a good chance it's still going to end up becoming a production with some version of the Sodbuster, whether it's the front flipper or whether we change it up and do a different opening mechanism or whatever. So.
Yep. All right. But, that was just a question from one of my good Instagram friends that, you know, he was like, hey, you know, when's he doing Sodbusters again? I was like, I don't know. I'll ask him though.
Yeah.
So
I really wanted to do that one next. I just didn't feel like it was the right decision from a business standpoint of, you know.
Yeah. I know we had talked about it, you know, a bunch of times as far as like, you know, what you were thinking about doing next and stuff like that. Yeah. But yeah, I really like them. I liked them more as in the front flipper variation because it kind of stayed more to the, you know, traditional aesthetic.
Right.
But
right. Me too.
Once you put the thumb stud on, I think I preferred like the Tangent over that because it had sort of a similar,
right.
similar profile lines. Or, you know, sort yeah. of, a, you know.
But, I agree. Yeah.
You know, that's beside the point.
So we shall see.
Yeah. Into the other questions that we have, though, the ones that, you know, you've actually been briefed on a little bit. What is your favorite part of the making process? Designing, grinding, finishing, etc. Could be cool to hear both of you talk about this, considering y'all make stuff in different ways. And that's from Sam Didio, as is the first question and the next question. I just got them all from Sam this week. So,
well, hey, that'll work. Lots of questions. Why don't you take that one first, since you surprised me with the last one?
All right. honestly, probably design. And for me, the actual hands-on part is the most difficult part for me. I'm not that naturally gifted as far as being good with my hands. So that's always like a struggle and a fight and a, you know, a bear trap wrapped in one. So the whole design process is just where it's, you know, creativity and, you know, me imagining this knife. It's, you know, there, it's the conception of it. There's nothing wrong with it yet because I haven't touched it. So it's just a pure image in my mind that I'm trying to make come out on the paper. And so that's probably my favorite part. As far as like the actual process, to give like sort of a real answer, yeah, I don't know actually. Probably profiling, because that's basically the first. I used to equate it to like a first look when, you know, you're getting married, you know, that's the first time you see the thing that you've thought about. So like it's, you know, once you get that profile,
a bar of steel or whatever, like it's like you can actually see the physical thing.
Like So that sort of ties back to the design part. It's like the first chance you get to see it being actualized.
Yeah.
But yeah. So what that about you? Sense.
Yeah. Kind of similar. I do like the design side a lot, but I don't know. I might have to go with, and like you said, the kind of the reveal, so to speak, of the knife coming out of the material is different. So it's a little bit hard for me to answer this question now because the way I do things now is different. You know, most of the time I'm not even actually grinding the knife or profiling it or whatever. It's, you know, I'm putting it on the machine. So it's kind of the same thing, but like, you know, I guess you'd say, you know, if I went with what I'm, the way I do things now, probably the, you know, the, like you said, the profiling and stuff on the machine, whatever, the first time we'd run it, it actually becomes a part, you know, or a knife, whatever, like what depends on whether it's a folder or a fixed blade. But like first time you actually get to see the physical thing and hold it in your hands or whatever, that's probably the favorite. But I do still, my initial gut reaction when I read the question though, was the grinding, because that's still kind of, to me, the, you know, again, I don't really do much of that anymore. It's just done on the machine or whatever, or sent out CNC grinding, but that still kind of feels like the heart of the knife in a way. Like that's, cause even once it's profiled, it's still not a knife. It's just a
weirdly shaped chunk of metal. Yeah.
Right. Right. It will not function as a knife yet. So basically putting the bevels on it, to me, kind of is what turns it into a knife. So in a lot of ways, that's still kind of my favorite part of something new. It's just not something I do a whole lot anymore. But
yeah, that was what I expected you to say, was the grinding. You used to get down on that. It's way too stress inducing for it to be my favorite part. When it goes well, it's my favorite part.
Yeah.
but you know, sometimes it goes way, way off the rails and quickly.
Well,
so
all that scrap we were talking about
earlier. Yeah. Yeah. That, that happens for me too. So
messes up and try again.
Yep. I don't generate as much scrap, but it's it is a lot more heartbreaking to screw up one, I think, in my case, than it is to screw up just one of yours. Possibly.
Yeah. The only problem is a lot of times it's not just one that gets screwed up.
Because that's what I was, you know,
like when you do 12 blades on a pallet and you run a pallet, it something can happen to just one, like a part, I mean, a tool can break or something weird can happen on one.
Yeah.
But more often than not, it's all 12 of them. So. Yeah.
This is true.
It kind of, it still sucks times 12 then. So
all right, so moving on to the next one, Sam wanted to know about our knife collections and also what we are carrying for the day. And as far as knife collections, you know, he said we didn't have to like go into the whole deal. Yeah. Like, you know, we don't need to bring them all out and show them on camera, but like, just, you know, in general, what do you have, you know, what kind of interesting stuff do you have?
Yeah. To be honest with you, I don't have a really extensive cool knife collection. I've got a few cool pieces. I've got some of my stuff stuck back, like some prototypes and stuff that I stuck back. and kept. Those are special to me, you know, not necessarily because they're that great, but just because they were prototypes or whatever. But, and I have a few others that mean, like, I've got one that back when me and, Leong Ma were doing, I was making his designs or whatever, collaborating with him. Like, I've got one of those that I made him and I each one to keep. So I've got like one of those stuck back.
And that was the Warrior.
Yeah, I believe that was on the Warrior. Yeah. Yep. And then I really need to get into finding some of the stuff that I've had on my, that stuff always gets pushed to the back burner. Like, I've got stuff I want to get. I just always find a reason not to buy it yet. It's not that I can't, but I find a reason to put it off and not do it yet. I do have a cool, actually, I've got it right here in my desk drawer. I have a pretty cool, I don't know what year this was from, but it's an older Hinder 3-inch XM18.
Oh, yeah.
I got it through Steel Flame. They were doing back when they used to do, you see, it's got the Steel Flame Crusader clip on it, and it's got the Crusader.
I see it. Yeah.
Yeah. Laser engraving on it. So this was, they used to do on, I believe it was on the USN forum. I know it was on the USN forum. Steel Flame would do, like, yearly, they would do I forget what they called it. But they would do a drop where they would basically drop stuff randomly all throughout the day, and it would usually be at like stupid discounted prices, like just super like generous, just kind of like they're giving back kind of deal. Gotcha. And so I got lucky enough, and I tried to not like, I never wanted to like take advantage of their generosity and stuff. So I've always tried to support them. They are super generous people, but I typically didn't join in on that too much, but I did that Hinderer came along at the right time. And I mean, somebody was going to buy it for the price they were selling it for regardless. So it's not like, you know, I wasn't hurting them in any way. So I know. I kind of have a weird kind of,
no, I understand like that point of view. I mean, mine's more, I guess, like if I see another maker doing a giveaway, you know, I want the knife most of the time or want you know, whatever it is, but like, I feel weird entering it because I'm like, you know, that's for the customers that have supported them. That's not for me that they just talk to every now and then on Instagram, you know, like, so
similar kind of thing. So we've been fairly, at one point we were fairly prolific customers of Steel Flame. So I don't, you know, anyway, so I picked that up there. I cannot remember what they called that, but it was a really cool thing that they did. And I've had that one ever since. I've never actually, I guess you'd call it a safe coin. I've never actually carried it or used it or anything, but that's actually one of the fewer, you know.
From what I remember of your collection that you showed me, you had one that was it wasn't one of the customs, I don't think, but a Ram or.
Yeah, it was one. Yeah, it's one of the production versions. I actually think it was a Boker version or whatever.
Yeah, okay.
Actually, it's been a while since I've looked at some of my stuff, so I don't even remember what I had. Yeah, I had Ram. A lot of you probably never heard of Ram, but he was a really cool dude, custom knife maker. He did a collaboration with Boker, and he passed away really young several years ago. That's been, I don't even know how many years ago that's been now.
Yeah, I think that was
probably 15 years or something like that.
Maybe, yeah, getting close.
It's been a long time.
But yeah, I think Boker still makes the Ram designs in some capacity. So yeah, I mean, I think they're still out there.
Amy got me one of those one year. I think it was the year he passed. Like, she got me one for Christmas or something.
Yeah.
Just kind of as a commemorative kind of thing to remember him by. So him and I were in talks of working on a collaboration at the time. We hadn't actually gotten anything going that we could, you know, I wish we had had it going far enough that I could have, like, you know, completed it or whatever, but we had just started talking about it. So didn't happen, but yeah, so that was cool. I've got a lot of stuff that I had since I was a kid and stuff that are basically junk knives, you know, but they kind of mean something to me just cause I had them for, you know, so long and stuff like that. I mean, I'm sure we've all got some of those. So, and I showed that one. I don't actually think I have a sharp finger right now.
Yes, you do. I gave it to you.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
it did. Because
I've actually got a couple other that you gave to me as well. Hold on. I've got one that you gave to me.
Yeah, most of his recent knife acquisitions, I think, have come from me. But you know. But.
Yeah, because I'm like, again, I get really. I don't have it on me, but I've got the box in here. I bought one of Tactile Knife Company's Rangers. Their slip joint. That's actually the most recent knife that I bought for myself. I really just wanted to, I liked it a lot. I liked them. I wanted to check it out, so I got it. But yeah, this is one that Chase made for me.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, well, really cool. Yeah, the camera's not going to do it justice. Damascus, really cool. Remind me which model this is.
That's the Fjord.
Fjord, yep.
Yeah.
Super cool. He gifted me that a while back. Really cool.
I think that was your birthday of some year.
Yeah.
But I shall not mention.
Oh, here's another one. Sorry, I'm not going to keep going too long. This is actually probably the first custom knife that I bought.
Oh, yeah.
This was made by a gentleman named G.L. Drew. So it's just a little cool little fixed blade. I think the sheath was as much what drew me to it as anything. I was we were up there, and speaking of the mountains, we were up there in Sevierville one year, and they had a knife show going on, and we went to it. I don't remember what the name of it was. It was like the Great Smoky Mountains Custom Knife Show or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I was into making knives at the time, and I had something of mine on me, and that was half the reason I wanted to go to the show, was to try to get some advice and feedback and stuff. And I stopped and talked to that gentleman, and he gave me a couple of things some feedback on my knife that I showed him, and I ended up buying that little fixed blade off of him. Again, I've never carried it or anything like that. I thought it was cool. I think that was the first knife show that I ever went to, if I remember correctly. So that was kind of a commemorative of my first knife show. So,
yep.
And then real quickly, and I'll be done. I showed this the other day, but that Buck Crosslock.
Oh yeah.
This is not the knife that I had. I bought this one off eBay not that long ago, but it's the model that I carried a lot in the Marine Corps, and it was just my little go-to thumb stud knife in the Marine Corps. That really the first knife that I remember getting me into like thumb stud opening knives and stuff. So,
yep.
So that one's kind of got a special place for me. But so, all right, I've rambled about my stuff long enough. What you got?
All right. I'm kind of all over the place. I mean, I've got a, you know, fair amount of, you know, just CRKTs and Kershaws and stuff like that I still carry. And, you know, most of the time these days I'm carrying either one of my folders or a Spyderco, and I'll usually carry one of my fixed blades with it. You know, just since I've got into carrying fixed blades, I basically carry one every day. That was basically like, whenever I made my first fixed blade, I put it on my belt, and since then I basically carried a fixed blade every day. So, got a few, you know, I like to, when I can, get fixed blades from other makers because they're generally cheaper, and you know, I like fixed blades, so it's not a problem, but I like to get fixed blades from other makers, and I'll generally carry one of my folders. Got some Spydercos. I've got a Delica, a Dragonfly, a PM2 that I'm actually carrying today.
I got one of those too. I didn't even think to name all that stuff, but yeah.
But yeah. You know, I don't have a whole lot of custom. I've got two custom folders, two and a half. The Mac 2 3-inch that I have is hand ground by Jonathan. So sort of a half custom and, you know, half pre-made parts, I guess. And then I got a Walter Wells little custom folder in my Carta, and an Aaron Frederick SMK. But, you know, I don't have like a whole huge knife collection as far as like a bunch of premium stuff, I guess. I've got a bunch of stuff, but it's not, you know, most of it's cheaper stuff. And that's kind of where my wheelhouse lies as far as stuff I like is, you know, stuff I can just beat on and not, you know, I like the design, so that's good enough. So.
Well, I think honestly that you and I both, some of it goes into the fact that what we were talking about earlier, where we could both buy more knives and more expensive knives and stuff, but we're always reinvesting money into our business and stuff. Like, it's hard for me to justify buying a knife just because I want it. Now, like, if it's something that I'm wanting to, you know, not copy, but if it's something I'm wanting to try to, like, learn something from it or whatever, or check out, you know, example of somebody's work or whatever, like, I can kind of justify that in my mind. But otherwise, it's like, you know, okay, is this a frivolous expense? You know, could I spend this money better on something that we need for the shop or whatever? So, and I know you're doing the same thing. That's for sure the way I was up to this point.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, there's been a few knives that I've purchased for the reasons of checking them out so I could kind of learn from them. Like, you know, mm-hmm. I showed you that Wilson Techline little survival knife. It's the Pack Light, I think is what it's called.
Yeah, and those are on my list to get.
He's a guy I want to talk about at some point, but it's basically like a little baby tiny 2-inch blade, but, you know, 4 or 5 inch handle survival knife, like hollow handle, everything, all made in the US, and just neat thing, basically. Right. You know, I love those. When I was a kid, I used to just, you know, strap a cheap, crappy, you know, those $10 flea market survival knife to me and a BB gun, and I was off for the day. You know, whatever I wanted to go do that day, I could do with those two things, or, you know, at least until I broke something or hurt something, but, you know. But yeah, in addition to the PM2, I always carry a, now I've killed the microphone.
You're talking about tearing stuff up. There you go.
Yep. I always carry a Swiss Army knife with me. I'm a Swiss Army knife fanatic. That's a tinkerer that I put different scales on. And then I've got my Modal Art prototype fixed blade. So, like I said, I generally carry a fixed blade. I generally carry a modern folder. And then I always carry a Swiss Army knife at the very least. So,
yeah.
That's very what I'm carrying, sort of my knife collection as it stands. So,
yep, very cool. It's kind of cool how I've never been necessarily a collector of, like, trying to go hunt, get all of the newest things by certain makers or whatever. It's more stuff that has, like, I end up collecting stuff that has, like, sentimental value for some reason or whatever. You know?
Yeah, and I sort of mentioned this, like, I did a shop tour series, I guess, because Instagram wouldn't let me post the full video. But you know, I've got a cabinet in my shop where I keep like a old Camillus Navy Mark II that was my great granddad's, and I've got an Ontario Jet Pilot survival knife. I've got a Buck 119 special along with a Buck 110, just sort of like a little bit of history in a cabinet sort of thing. Like, I like to collect little sets like that, and it's not usually anything new or prestigious that the YouTubers are talking about. It's just whatever I want to do. So,
yeah, I think too, like, I've always had, it's not that I don't want other people's stuff, because I do. It's just, I've always been, and some of it's just that do it yourself kind of mindset. Like, you know, again, I'm not going to see something that somebody else has made that I really like and go try to make a version of it. But it kind of like inspires me to want to make something new or cool or whatever for myself. You know what I mean? It might not be anything like what they made, or it might be in the same, you know, it might be a recurve, and that might be the only thing that's the same about it that I saw on somebody else's, but it kind of sparks that, you know, okay, yeah, that's super cool, and I really like that. Let me see what I can do myself, you know, and do with it.
Yeah.
I think that's some of the reason I don't collect more stuff than I do as well, and probably you too. It ended up inspiring you as much as anything to go and do something of your own.
Yeah.
So it's, and one more thing that I have noticed, I'll be honest with you, there's nearly every show that I do recently, probably in the last several years, I will have the intention of going and looking, like, cause I've got a couple of things on my list that I want, and I'll tell myself, cause I would just, I don't know, it just feels different to be able to, even if I can't get it, cause some of the stuff's not necessarily, I'm not necessarily looking to get it brand new from the maker or whatever.
Yeah.
Some of it, like, I'm not going to be able to go and like be the first person at their table and stuff to go get it or whatever. So, like, I don't mind, you know, finding one in a collection somewhere at Blade Show or whatever and buying it there. So I'll always tell myself, it just seems cooler to buy it in person, even if it's from just a dealer or a collector that's there or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I have good intentions of like, okay, I'm going to see if I can find me one of these, you know, specific model or whatever that I'm wanting at the next show. And then guess what? Next show comes around, we stay wide open, you know, the show's over, and I'm like, you know, feel like I'm coming out of a coma or something.
Yeah,
I'm like,
what just happened?
Like, I don't even know where the last 2 days went. So
yep.
I, it, I don't end up shopping, and there you go. So
yeah,
I do have intentions. I just don't ever seem to be able to make good on them. Very rarely.
It's difficult. Cause I mean, every second you're away from the table, you kind of feel a little guilty. And I know you've got employees and other people that can watch the table as far as like stuff, be there to sell product, but people are coming there, no offense to Luke, but they're not coming there to meet Luke. Right. They're coming there to meet the maker. They're coming there to see you. They're coming there to see me.
I hate to disappoint them like that, but in person, then be like, oh, that dude's a jerk. No, I'm kidding. Hopefully not many people walk away saying that.
Yeah.
I'm sure there have been a few.
Yeah.
But every now and then,
it's hard to have like guilt-free blade show fun. And
again, we're there to work. We're not actually there to shop and stuff. So
I would say that's probably the worst part about being a knife maker is not being able to actually enjoy knife shows.
Right.
But
one of these days I'm gonna go to a show and like just to go and not exhibit or something, but it's just like, can't not exhibit at the major ones. So I don't know. But anyway, all right. So before we get to running too long again this week, what do we got up next? Did that get all the questions covered?
Yeah, that's all the questions. Now it's just, what do you got going on this week or coming up, near future?
Yeah. For us, it's pretty much, it's just a continuation from, last week to this week. Basically, still, we're starting to get, we've got some stuff as far as kind of our standard stuff made up for Texas. Like, we'll just basically select some stuff out of the stuff that we have made up. Got to decide what I'm going to do for maybe some special stuff. I got to see what I've got out there. If I can get some blades back from heat treat in time, I would like to take a couple of hand ground, or I'm probably, honestly, anything I do from now on that's hand ground, for the most part, I'm probably going to basically hand grind it, build it myself, and call it a custom. Like, some of the hand ground stuff I've done in the past, I didn't really feel like calling it a custom because I hand ground the blade, but I wasn't necessarily one that actually did the rest of the stuff building the knife. So, and honestly, there's probably not going to be a time again anytime soon where, somebody else probably did something to the knife. Like, somebody probably cleaned up the burrs off the handles when they came off the machine and, that kind of stuff. But I feel like if I at least, at the very least grind the blade and do the assembly and all that, then I'm okay with calling that a custom. So,
are you going to mark them different or any plans to do that?
I honestly haven't decided exactly what I'm going to do, but we'll
do something. Didn't know if you'd break Sam out of retirement or.
Yeah, we might have to. Yeah, might go back to the custom logo that we did on those. And so anyway, don't know that I'm going to end up having time to get that done, but so basically getting ready for Texas. We've got, we're about to this coming week, we should be able to finally drop some 3.5-inch Gen 2 backspacers, which people have been waiting on and rabidly asking about. So
I meant to ask you about that. I was re-listening to some of the older episodes and you had talked about trying to figure that out. And so,
yeah. And we have it. So the problem is that I didn't want to take the time or whatever to try to figure out how to do them one at a time. So to prototype them, we're prototyping 48 at a time. So it takes a long time on the machine because I'm figuring out a way to do them, to cut them all out of a sheet all at the same time. So we're doing them, with the whole sheet on the mill or plate, whatever you want to call it. But it takes a long time because there's a lot of material to remove and a lot of stuff to do to make those with the little standoffs on each side.
Yeah. That's a ton of material.
lots of holes to drill, lots of holes to thread
on
48 standoffs, so, putting the jimping on them and all that. So anyway, so that took a lot longer for me to figure out how to do them and not having to do them one or two at a time. And then now getting the actual finished product. We do have a few finished. Yeah. The first round of them that we did, I screwed up and I put the wrong size drill in there. And instead of doing a tap drill, I put a through drill, which means the holes were too big to thread. So those were no good. 48 of those ruined. Well, we're going to turn them into, we're going to grind the standoffs off each side and they'll still work as Gen 1 for anybody that still wants a Gen 1 backspacer. So they're not technically totally scrapped.
Yeah.
But then The second one, we did it, but some of them we didn't quite get the fit exactly right on the standoffs where they go into the counterbores in the in the handles. Yeah. And most of them can be salvaged, but it's taken some work by hand to do it. So we haven't gotten all of those cleaned up yet. And we've got some on the machine now that are 80% of the way done that still lack another little bit more machine time. And I'm hoping they basically come off the machine just needing a little bit of deburring and clean up and be good to go. So,
yeah.
So
that would be ideal.
Yes. That's what we're working for. So close on that. That's another fairly big thing. We're running spear points and some more tantos at the moment on the machines. We're building some spear points and some drop points at the moment. And with some of our new, still doing more of the black anno, doing some, a lot of the newer stuff, like the swerve engraving or milling pattern. We're doing a good bit of that. Just doing,
that swerve pattern's very nice.
I like it too. Like it.
Yeah. I finally saw like a close up of it today, and like there's a lot going on there. But
yeah, I can't wait.
It's visually appealing. What?
Yeah. Well, if you saw the one that one guy that Andy posted, that's not a normal swerve.
Andy.
Well, Tennessee EDC or EDC Tennessee. No. He took a real close up shot of it, like of the handle. I don't know if that's the picture you're talking about or not.
It was a real close up, but yeah, so it may not be. Okay.
Those have more going. That one he's got has more going on than anything than the normal ones because they were, we're calling them a double swerve. It was basically I screwed up and accidentally, like they got more than they were supposed to get. And they look pretty cool, but they're not the actual way it's supposed to look. And there's only a handful of them. He got one and we're going to be posting a few more and selling them off as kind of a limited deal. And then those will, unless I screw up again, that'll be the end of those.
Right.
But that being said, the normal swerves, the ones especially that have like a two-tone finish with like the satin flats on top that are anodized a different color or whatever.
Yeah.
You almost have to hold those and look at them to really appreciate them because I cannot get decent pictures of, because they, every time you move them a little bit in the light, like they kind of change. Like, they're like kind of iridescent. Like, so the pictures or even videos really don't do them justice. But
I'm excited to check those out at Texas if I can get over your table soon enough before they're gone.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. So anyway, doing that, and we're just running. My last thing is we just started running some more speed hole handles, which we haven't done in a while.
Yeah.
So I'm anxious to get some of those out there. We've never done very many of them, but those are kind of a throwback to, I did a lot of speed holes on my custom stuff back in the day. So glad to get back to doing some of those. I think they're going to look really cool. And we may even do some, we may even play with some of the two-tone finish stuff on those and do some highlights in the holes or something like that. So
that'd be cool.
Yeah. So what do you got going on?
A lot of the same, you know. I'm still just plugging away on my, I've rebranded my anniversary sets, and they are no longer sets. They are fleets because they are groups of boats. And
that makes sense.
That made me chuckle. So on fleet number 4 was a set of S110. The blade steel was S110V. And I sent you a picture earlier this week where I actually melted the,
that made me cringe.
Melted or burned the tip of the blade off of the fixed blade. So, yeah, I had to kind of restart. That's actually what I was working on before I came up here for this. I got those, the new blades are crew wear. And so I got those cut out and surface ground and profiled. And I was getting close to wrapping them up to put them into normalized for heat treat. So that's my goal for today, is get that done and get that back on track. Also did another, speaking of speed holes, doing speed holes in a folder for the first time.
Cool.
Actually, a customer requested it. So
I didn't realize you'd never done that. Yeah,
no,
that's cool.
I did it once on a fixed blade. Way back, you know, I was still in your shop probably first year or so. And but otherwise I've never, I don't know. Once it got to, you know, I can put 2 holes in something and it looks fine. But once you get to 3 holes, you got to be real precise in, you know, spacing and, you know, top to bottom.
It's weird too, because you can't just draw, most of our handles and stuff are not straight. So you can't just draw a straight line and put evenly spaced holes on that line.
Yep.
They technically have to be like off center, but they have to match like the handle as far as where they fall on the curves of the handle. Like, it's kind of hard to explain, but like, there's definitely some kind of like artistic expression that has to go on there to kind of make them look the way that so they actually flow with the design.
Yeah. So, and I, did my best. The guy who I'm building the knife for seemed excited about it. I sent him a picture of it. And so, you know, it's coming out pretty cool. I got to, you know, do a few more things to it and get it ready to go. I'm still got to finish cutting the lock bar and, you know, grind the blade and a bunch of stuff like that. But, you know, I wanted to go ahead and get the, you know, before I completely committed to setting the lock and everything in this set of frames, I was like, okay, let's get that part out of the way and, you know, kind of work ourselves up.
In case you mess it up, you don't have all that other work into it.
Yep. Yeah. Basically.
I understand.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Yeah. I'm anxious to see that then.
Yeah. And, otherwise, you know, I cut a bunch of lock bars this week because that involved, you know, me sitting in a single place and the heater being on me when it was like 12
that was
degrees.
A good call.
So I sat at the mill and just cranked the handle back and forth for a day basically and cut all the lock bars for the fleet series. So that's
very cool.
Basically what I got going on.
All right, cool. So Texas, remind me the dates of Texas again.
I still haven't double checked, but I still believe it is March 7th and 8th.
March 7th and 8th. Okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
Did you just have a panic
attack? That's a huge relief. I still had it in my head that it was in, because it was in February last year.
Yeah, it was in February last year.
So I still, like, I've got actually a little more time than I thought I did.
Yeah.
When you said 7th and 8th, I was thinking, oh my God, like, that's
Yeah, no, if it was the 7th and 8th, I wouldn't be here talking. I'd have to be just out there until the 7th or 8th.
I'm pretty sure you're right about that, and I'm glad I asked you to remind me because, I still had February stuck in my head from last year, so.
Yep.
I might actually get a one or two hand ground. We'll see. No promises, but all right, cool. Well, so, and on that note about Texas, let's go ahead and remind everybody where we're going to be. So what's your table number?
My table number is 10K. So
10K. All 10K. Right. I like that.
Yeah.
That's got a nice ring to it. So, and you said your neighbors with who?
I know one of my neighbors is Caleb White. He's another maker that I really like, and I got to meet him at the Nashville Custom Show, and really good maker. But
that'd be cool. So you guys head over there to 10K and then whatever Caleb's table is and check those out.
Whatever comes before then, K, yeah.
There you go. ABJ, FK, somewhere in there. Is it right?
H-I-J-K, J. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Total, I swear I know the alphabet.
I swear I do too. I just got to say it in
sequence. It's a little different when you're on the spot and knowing people are listening. Might need to edit that out, but I'm fine with people knowing I'm ditzy sometimes. All right, so we are at booth 309. We're in a cluster there with some really good company. We're going to be we're going to be shoulder to shoulder with Doug from Attention to Detail Mercantile, and then I know Bradford Knives, I think, is one of the ones behind us, and I can't remember who else is behind us. Oh, Peter Carey.
Peter Carey.
Really good dude, custom maker. We're in a cool little quad there. So excited about that. I'm looking forward to that. This will be our first year in a booth at Texas. So I'm looking forward to that. So, guys, please, I said it last couple of episodes, but if you are not sure yet about coming to Texas, then I highly recommend it. It's a good show. It's a lot of fun. We look forward to seeing everybody. So those of you that are coming, we'll see you there. And I guess that about wraps it up for this week. So we will be back next week to burn your ears a little more.
Yeah.
Maybe have something to rant about, or maybe we'll just keep it all nice and fun and up lighthearted next week. We'll see. Depends on what happens between now and then.
Yeah. You never know.
All right. We appreciate you guys.
Yep. We'll see you next time.